Hi there, everyone, and welcome to the Bubble Hour, where real people tell real stories of addiction and recovery. I'm Jean McCarthy, author and blogger over at Unpickled. I've been telling my story there of life after alcohol since my very first day of sobriety in 2011. I tell my story there, and I hold space for your stories here. And today on the show, my guest is an amazing woman. I've met her a couple of times in person and never had enough time to talk with her as much as I've wanted to. So I'm really happy she's here with me this morning. Her name is Kendra Ogden, and she has asked me to use her full name because she is committed to recovering out loud. She's a licensed addictions counselor who treats clients in an intensive outpatient program. And we will learn more about that after we get to know Kendra and hear her story. Hi, Kendra. Welcome.
Hi, Jean. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. And your voice is so cheerful. You're just cheering me up. Better than that cup of coffee.
Really awesome.
You know?
Right. I don't even drink caffeine, so that's how weird I am.
Really? Have you never? Or did you get off of it?
I just kind of got off of it. I'll drink a pop every once in a while, but I've never liked coffee. I'll do green tea, but that's just like another layer of addiction I don't need. So people look at me and go, why don't you try it? And I'm like, well, because I don't like it. And they're like, well, it's an acquired taste. Well, why would I want to acquire that taste?
Isn't everything bad for us an acquired taste? Like
exactly.
Cigarettes, coffee, alcohol.
We didn't like that first drink, but we had to try it, right? So
yeah, we powered through till we couldn't live without it. Oh,
exactly.
Man, so true. Well, I am excited to hear your story. So please
tell us. So please.
Great. Well, let's get to know you a little bit and tell us about who you are and how you got to where you are today.
Absolutely. Well, I always start when I speak with groups or with anybody publicly, I always tell that the last day that I had to use any kind of alcohol or drug to alter my mood or my feelings or run away from how I was feeling was September 19th of 2010. So I have just a little over 9 years. And I can tell you that 10 years ago, I never thought that this life that I have was possible, that I didn't want it. I didn't think that I always imagined my life using substances in one form or another. So I never thought that I could be what I am today. And I like to say that my life, by the end of my addiction, was so limited that I didn't go anywhere. I was isolated. I pretty much had family left in my life, and that was it. And then even then, I was trampling all over those guys. And I had nothing really going for me except to use and just repeat that cycle over and over again. And so I have like this infinite ability now to do anything I want to do. And that's, I think, through the power of recovery. And that's why I think it's important to recover out loud, because I know there's a lot of people that are struggling and they have a lot of shame and stigma around addiction and mental health disorders. And I just want to blast that out of the universe. And, you know, we wouldn't be ashamed if we had diabetes or heart disease or cancer. In fact, people rally around you. So why are we ashamed? Why do we lose our housing? Why does our family shun us when we have an addiction, which is a chronic disease that's deadly? So that's kind of where I start. So I know what was important in my life was it started even really before I was born. So I do want people to understand that my family of origin was very beautiful and loving and kind. They never was never abused or neglected. But I think what's significant is I was adopted, and I think that created kind of an attachment wound right from the beginning. And I remember as a kid, and I couldn't tell you this as a 7-year-old, but I remember feeling like I had to perform to have someone love me. And I had to be the fastest on the team or get the best grades. And so I always had this outer sense of validation. I wasn't able to validate myself from internally validation. And that I learned through lots of years of recovery and like therapy and 12 steps. But even as a sober person, I still felt like other people had to validate me. And I remember a time in early recovery when someone said, Kendra, not everyone's going to like you. And I was like, what? What do you mean not everyone likes me? And she said, well, do you like everyone? And I said, no, there's some people I tolerate. And she said, exactly. Some people will tolerate you and some people will like you. And I was like, oh, okay. So that was kind of the beginning of that. But so I really think about the last treatment center that I went to talked about these four core addictions, or PMLE refers to them as like a core issue. And so my first one is validation, really outwardly seeking other people's approval. And along with the validation goes with control. And I try to control a relationship. So I'll control it with money or humor or anger. I'll become whatever you want me to be so that you'll love me and approve me and validate me. And so that started. And it continued through not only through my addiction and before my addiction, but throughout even my early recovery, my early sobriety, because I was still not finding who I truly was. So that was a lot of places. It was a place of pain for a while. So I guess like a lot of my recovery story, I mean, it's really not about the substance, but I know I'll tell a little bit about my substance use, because it's really about the way I think and the way I view my life. So my first drink was I was age 14, and it became my first drunk. And every time I could drink, I did. And every time I did drink, I got drunk. So there was never a point in my life where I can try to control my substance use. Something external may have controlled it, like maybe I ran out or my mother found my stash or she pushed my wine glass away at dinner, but there was nothing internally that ever wanted me to control my use. And so I think I was an addict from the very beginning, because it relieved that feeling of not feeling like I was enough, and it relieved that feeling of not belonging. And it was a weird felt sense that I had as a kid that I just didn't feel like I fit in. And I don't know if that was the adoption or if that's just the filter that I saw the world. And that's just kind of what started it. So I used alcohol through high school and into college, where I was introduced to marijuana, hallucinogenics. I went to the University of Kansas, go Jayhawks. I didn't complete my degree because of my addiction. And you could see my academic progress decline as my alcoholism and addiction rose. And it's just almost like you could graph it on the XY coordinates, and you could see Kendra failing in school as her drinking increases. And I'm having consequences. I'm wrecking cars. I have DUIs. I remember waking up one morning and on my porch. Apparently, I had driven home and passed out before I got to the door. I live in Minnesota, but I used to live in Kansas. In Minnesota, people do that here, and they die. Like, they die of exposure. So I was definitely having physical and academic consequences and legal consequences. But I had this idea in my head, this belief system about what an addict or what an alcoholic looked like, and I was not it. You know, I think a lot of people will talk about this. Like, an alcoholic is if you close your eyes and I ask you to describe what an alcoholic looks like, we were going to say, about a 40 or 50-year-old man. He's going to have a bulbous nose. He's white. He's maybe disheveled. He may be homeless. He may be incoherent. But I didn't fit that description. I wasn't drinking from a paper bag. I had a house. I had a car. I was going to school. Even if I was failing, I was still going to school. So this belief system of what an addict and what an alcoholic looked like did not fit with me. So it kept me sick for a good number of years. After I didn't graduate college, but I pretended to, and I always had this thought that I would go back and I would finish my degree at some point, and kind of like, I don't know if anybody else has felt this, but tomorrow I'll get in shape, or tomorrow I'll stop drinking, or tomorrow I'll read that self-help book and I'll get better then. And that tomorrow never came for me. I just kept drinking. I kept getting deeper into drugs, and it just kept growing. And I started to work for my father, who is a broker-dealer in Kansas, and I became a successful financial planner. And again, that idea, that vision of what an alcoholic is, that's not me. I have a successful job. I have two cars in the garage now. I have a house. I can take trips. And in my relationships, I was using that kind of grandiosity and that money to control people. Like, I've got dinner. I'll buy dinner. I'll put it on my expense account. And it was all about this kind of false sense of importance, because inside I felt absolutely like a fraud. I felt like I was empty inside. I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. But I didn't let anybody get too close to me so they would see that ever. And I used money and influence to try to create those friendships but also to keep people at a distance. And that worked for a very long time. Somewhere in my story, I don't remember how old I was. I guess I was 27. I identify now as a cisgendered lesbian. At the time when I was growing up, 1980s Kansas is not exactly a very queer-friendly community, and it's still not really super friendly there. But the message I heard when I said to my mom in high school, hey, I think I like girls, was, oh, you can't do that. You can't feel that. That's wrong. And so the message I got was, my reality is wrong. My feelings are wrong. And so whatever I feel must be so shameful that I have to bury it very deeply. And I think that is another thing that really drove my alcoholism. And so when I finally came out of the closet, I remember feeling, wow, oh my gosh, I felt so relieved. Like, relieved, like this must be why. This must be why I'm an alcoholic. And the truth is, no, I'm an alcoholic. It has nothing to do with sexual identity or sexual orientation. But then what happened was I started going to gay clubs and hanging out with people that were partying even stronger than I was. And I was introduced to cocaine. And that was my drug of choice. That became my drug of choice. Alcohol was just cocaine actually let me drink more, but alcohol was kind of a secondary thing. And about a year after starting cocaine, someone introduced me to crack cocaine. And that was even more of a thrill for me. And I sought it out. I found some people to teach me how to use crack cocaine. And that started probably a 15-year addiction and love affair with crack cocaine. And it ruined my life. It took everything away from me. I lost my job. I lost a lot of friends. I just stopped actually even being a part of people because it's not like you can be a social crack smoker. It's not a very social drug. And so that's kind of what happened. And I kept using, I isolated, I was sent to treatment a couple of times, but each time I was sent to treatment, I didn't want to be sober. I just wanted the world to get off my back. I wanted my mom and dad to not punish me for stealing. I wanted my girlfriend to come back. I wanted the law not to throw me in jail. And I didn't want to be sober. I didn't think, that's that piece where I didn't think I could have the life I have now, but it wasn't possible. And so I kept using, literally my day looked like figure out how to get my drugs, use as much as I can, maybe get some sleep, maybe eat something, and then repeat it every day. And it was just an empty life. I was not contributing to the world at all. And I can tell you now that it's that no purpose in life was not working for me. In 2008, I got pulled over by a small town police officer. Seven cop cars arrested me, which may have saved my life. But I continued to use another 2 years after that. And I remember when I was pulled over, I was like, how dare he pull me over? Like, I'm an upstanding citizen. And the reality was that I was driving a truck that was registered to my mother. I didn't have a valid driver's license. I didn't have insurance. I was on my way to a dealer's house with money in my pocket and drug paraphernalia. And I was probably high from the night before. So this delusion that I had of, like, me being an upstanding citizen was exactly that, a delusion. And so if we talk about, again, like validation and control, the third addiction or crisis issue that I have is sensation. I like to get high. I like to get drunk. I like to ride motorcycles to this day. I drive fast. Kendra had this idea that the rules don't apply to Kendra. She can do whatever she wants. That includes not paying tickets or fines or bills. And so this kind of like unmanageability that they talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous was completely all over my life. And so I continued on this path of using, despite the fact that I was facing significant jail time. I had five felonies. I couldn't find a job. So I just kept on using. Finally, my probation officer said, hey, we're gonna execute your sentence because you obviously can't stay sober. So you need to figure this out. And so I begged for treatment. And this time I was scared because I didn't want to go to jail. And it was the first time that someone introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous and to my first sponsor actually had a life, and she had kids, and she happened to be a lesbian, and she was married with children, and she had a good job, and she was working for Microsoft. And I was like, you mean I could do something like this? And she's like, absolutely, but you got to stay sober. And so I completed that treatment. I asked for more treatment, and that treatment, I decided to get a girlfriend in treatment because that's healthy. And so I did. I went against all staff approval, and we started having a relationship. We eventually were thrown out, and the selfishness of my disease didn't care that she had to complete treatment in order to get her child back from CP. And people will talk a lot about relapses and that you haven't done that yet. And that was my not yet moment. And so the reality was that I became trapped in a relationship that was codependent and violent. She was relapsing on narcotics. We had a child that was hers that we finally got back to CP. But and people often want to talk about like what the partner did to them. But the truth is, the way I showed up was I became verbally and physically and emotionally violent. I pushed her. I threw things. I slammed doors. I yelled. I screamed. And the only thing I can tell you is that I felt trapped, but I could have walked away at any time. But this codependence inside me was so strong. And I remember telling her, my love is different. My love will change you. My love will fix you. And it's so sick looking back on it. I can see that now. But so then I started relapsing. She went to jail. The child went into permanent adoption placement, which was probably the best thing for him. And I was like, you know what? Screw this. I had had maybe 5 months of sobriety, maybe a little bit longer. And I said, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. This feelings and having relationships. I'm obviously not good at it. I'm just going to go back and be an addict. That worked for a little bit until my probation officer called me and reminded me that they were going to execute my sentence because I hadn't completed treatment. And so I begged for one more chance. And they actually my therapist sent me to a place in Canada, up in Montreal. May I say the name?
Yes, please.
Yes. Yeah, Chatsworth Pavilion in Montreal. And it's a unique place because they talk about these core issues that I've talked about, the validation, the control, the sensation, and the final one, which fits that last relationship, is crisis. I love to find people that are broken so I can fix them so that they need me. And in early recovery, crisis looks like gossiping or sabotaging yourself. And I was really good at that. And so, but they worked the 12 steps around the four core addictions. And then they labeled me. I'd been to plenty of other like clinical treatments before, but they never really told me what my diagnosis was. And they said, Kendra, you're an alcoholic, a cocaine addict, and a love addict. And I can tell you from experience, the cocaine and the alcohol was hard to come off of, but boy, the love addiction took years. It took years to get, not only to identify it because it's subtle, but to really address it and work through it. So I followed their recommendations. I went to a halfway house. I followed those recommendations, and I went to a sober living arrangement. If I total the time that I was in any kind of institution, I was monitored or supported, it would be a better way to say supported, for 18 months. And because I hadn't taken a sober breath since I was about 17, and by this time I was 42. So I really needed that support, and I was really grateful that my parents were able and willing to help me. They basically said, as long as you're doing what you say you're going to do and you stay sober, we'll be glad to pay your rent. We'll take care of you until you're on your feet. And so I was able to volunteer and work on and focus on my sobriety. And I know a lot of people don't have that gift, and I'm very grateful for that. So one of my journeys along that journey is a place here in Minneapolis called The Retreat, and it's a 12-step immersion-based program. They have about 400 volunteers go through it, so meaning that they don't have a huge staff. They don't have a clinical staff. It's really just the 12 steps. And I say just the 12 steps, like it's just the 12 steps. But it's an amazing place. It has a lot of spirituality, and it's the first place that, you know, everyone kept wanting to tell me what was wrong with me and the pathology and of the brain and the science of the brain. But this was the first place that said, it's okay. We're just like you. And everyone identifies as either an alcoholic or an addict or someone in Al-Anon. And they taught me the big book. And, I know that now as a counselor, I know there's many, many ways of getting sober, but for me, Alcoholics Anonymous was my spiritual place. They didn't care that I was an addict. They didn't care that that's my drug of choice. I found a spiritual guide there. I'd never had a sense of God or higher power before I started this work. In fact, I was actually very cynical and sarcastic about God, and I was confusing men of religion with the spirituality piece. And so at the retreat, I found that out about myself, and I was able to let go of that ego that was keeping me from accepting the help or asking for help from a higher power. And I worked the 12 steps. I got a sponsor. I lived in the sober house. And my life started. I remember my first sponsor saying this phrase that said, praying to a God that I don't understand and getting results that I can't deny. And that was my life. And I was starting to get results I didn't deny. But it still took me a couple of years to really understand how to, quote unquote, use God, like how to talk to God, because I thought that it had to be in church or in a certain way, or, you know, and I was still kind of like imagining this God of Christian God. And I realized that I could, no, like the big book says, you can have your own conception of God, whatever that looks like. And I just started, asking other women in the program, like, how do you connect with your God? What does your God look like? And how do you talk to God? And I learned just to basically have a conversation. So in the morning, the first thing I do is I wake up and I say, thank you. And I say, thank you for waking me up sober. Thank you for the physical and mental abilities you've given me. Thank you for all the abundance in my life, and please guide and direct my thinking and my actions today so I can do what's best for the world. And it's some kind of phrase like that. It's not perfect every day, but it's something like that. And then I have moments during the day where it's just I used to call them coincidences, but now I can attribute them to some kind of power in the universe. And I say thank you. I say thank you for the realization. I was just at a gym working out today, and as I was leaving, there was a gentleman walking in who was either had an accident or a stroke, and he's struggling to walk, but he's there to get on the bike and work out that morning. And I thought to myself, and I just said, thank you, God, for all those times that I've tried to hurt myself intentionally, unintentionally, of car wrecks, you know, and I'm still standing on 2 feet and able to run, and I have these abilities, and I just, that's different than I ever would have been without any kind of recovery. I never would have said thank you. Like, I'm in control of life. You kidding me? Like, thank you to me, right? But my higher power kind of looks like there's a part in the big book that talks about the singing of the spheres, and it's about the connection of the universe and that there's a harmony between the planets. And I believe there's a harmony between us humans, that we have energy and that we are energetic bodies, and what we put out into the universe, we get back tenfold. So if I'm putting out positivity and happiness, I'm going to get that back. If I'm negative and cynical and sarcastic, I'm going to get that back. And I know that this world right now is like kind of polarized, and it's disturbing, but I try to see people as teachers. So I another phrase I like to say is, on my path of recovery, I've never met an enemy. I've only met friends and teachers. And for me, that means that, you know, even the people that I'm not really, really attuned with or that I don't agree with, I can see them as human beings who have made mistakes, who are precious and are children of God or are children of the universe, and that they have a light down deep inside them that's really important to see that light. And some of the work I do with addicts and alcoholics is that many of us come into this world or come into this place where we're starting to get sober, and we have such a low value of self, and we don't see that we have any kind of worth or value. And trying to tap into what Pia Melody calls inherent value, dignity, and worth, that we all have it, that it's that phrase of I'm good even when, or I'm valuable even when. So I'm valuable even when I make a mistake. I'm valuable even at the weight that I'm at. I'm valuable even when I'm angry. Like, it's whatever you want to fill in the blank. But I have value and worth, and it can't be destroyed from external factors. And so that's kind of where I am right now. And so I recently got a job as an alcohol and drug counselor in the state of Minnesota. And it's that idea of being exactly where I'm supposed to be, that everything that I suffered through, everything that my life was about, now has meaning. And I go to work every day and I love it. My 8 hours flies by. That neediness that I had I talked a little bit about being a love addict. It kept me in sick relationships. But every time I had a relationship, I learned a little bit more about myself and about how I was showing up. And I finally worked with a Pia Melody, post-induction therapist, that talked about the childhood wounds. And I've worked in the last 2 years, 3 years about that wounding as a child, and I've reparented myself, and it's really changed my whole sobriety. And it has actually made me available to have a healthy relationship. And I don't know if you know this, but I got married in August to a beautiful woman named Dawn, and we're both addiction counselors. So we both have a collective dream of opening a holistic treatment center someday. And she's not only my friend, but she's my partner, and we cheer each other on. And she's a great addiction counselor as well. And I like that we're both changing lives. And so that's kind of where we are right now.
Congratulations on your recent marriage. That's wonderful. I actually met Dawn last summer or the summer before at a conference, and you guys are so happy. I'm so happy for you. As you talked, I took 2 pages of notes. I have so much to ask you.
I talk really fast.
Well, you have a lot of amazing things to say. I'm going to start by saying thank you, because as you describe being surrounded by 7 cop cars as a crack cocaine addict and, a pretty low bottom, hearing where you are today and hearing the joy and clarity in your voice and your self-awareness and your understanding and your compassion and your wisdom, for those of us that have someone in our life who is really struggling and we're scared they're not going to get it, thank you for reminding us that people do recover and that a low bottom is not an indication of an inability to recover, and neither is a high bottom an indication of safety.
I think there's this idea of bottoms that, I mean, actually at She Recovers in California, this was impactful to me. A woman stand up in the audience and said that she hated the word bottom because for her, her daughter died of a bottom. Her daughter was a heroin addict. And I think that we can create the bottom. I mean, we can still love our addicts. We can still be there for them and support them. And also say, you know, your behavior is not okay. Like, you can't come into my house and steal from me. And I'm not going to support your drug addiction. And I'm going to put boundaries up, but I'm going to still love you. And we can try to create the bottom to come a little faster, especially for, I mean, we got a lot of heroin and fentanyl on the streets up here in Minneapolis, I'm sure, like other cities do. And it's scary. I mean, people don't know what they're taking. So, yeah, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, I'm glad, and it's an important topic. And, yeah, the bottom is like it's the point of change, but it's not indicative of anything, really. I mean, it's not a predictor of anything. So I want to thank you for that. And then the last thing you talked about was reparenting yourself and going through that process. And you mentioned that the sort of core attachment wound of being adopted and yet having been raised by a good family, loving parents, and to still have a need to reparent. And I think a lot of us are afraid to do that reparenting work because we see it as some kind of an insult to our families, or we're afraid it's not going to be received well, or that we shouldn't complain or something. Do you see in your work, it seems to me, just in doing this show, that adoption comes up a lot. And is there a higher incidence of addiction among people that were adopted? And then how do any of us approach that reparenting piece without feeling guilty about the need to do it?
Sure. I don't know the statistics, but I know anecdotally, I know in my own experience, there's a word there called anecdotally, and I can't say it, but I know in my own experience in recovering and working with women in AA and also in the addiction field that there's a high number of us that are either adopted or in the foster care system. And one thing that we focus on at the treatment center I work at, we talk about like attachment wounds. And so like you could have a loving mom and dad, but they're emotionally unavailable. Maybe they work 60 hours a week, right? And you're a latchkey, they just call it a latchkey kid or whatever. So like you're raising yourself at some point. And that disruption of attachment, throw in a little bit of genetic predisposition for alcoholism or addiction, and you've got a perfect storm for an addict. And that detachment can happen whether or not you have, like you said, the early childhood wounding, or it's just the parents who are just too busy to emotionally attach with a child. And we're finding that wounding, that attachment wounding, is responsible for almost all mood disorders. So you think about alcohol, so ADD, attention deficit disorder, OCD, bipolar, depression, anxiety, pretty much everything but schizophrenia can almost be related back to a child of a child attachment disorder. And it's fascinating work. I like listening to Gabor Mate. He talks a lot about the wounding of the child. And that I think that's one thing that kept me from doing that work myself, was because I was so wrapped up in what my mom and dad would think. Like, what would they think? They're going to think that I'm upset at them or that I'm mad at them. And it's like, no, I have to understand that this is my story and that this is my perspective and that they have their perspective. And if I had had a brother or sister, they would have had a perspective too that would have been different from mine. Kind of like the idea that if we watch the same movie, your experience will be different than my experience based on past experience. And so I had to get over the fact that I wasn't in charge of their happiness, that I can't create the happiness for them and I can't protect them from being hurt. And if they decide to be hurt, that's up to them, and they are adults and they'll deal with it. And that was really significant for me, that my journey doesn't have to somehow impact their life.
I love how you frame that, because I have to tell you, I was just saying to someone yesterday to whom I'd recommended Pia Mellody's book, Facing Codependency. Fantastic book. But mm-hmm. I really have to go through that book in baby steps. I've been actually reading it for probably 18 months. And I really have to work through it slowly, because I so easily flip out of my experience as a person in recovery whose intention is to work on my own junk to thinking about, I have adult children, so oh my gosh, did I do this to my kids? And I right. keep flipping it, and I keep flipping my conscience. And I think the more it happens, that it's a defense mechanism in a way.
That's interesting, yes.
it stops me from going in and working on my stuff, and instead flips me back into that protective, safe, familiar area of people pleasing, guilt, shame, blah, 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 blah. And so I find that so interesting.
I think you're right. I think I like that blah, 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 blah. It's a technical term. I think you're right, because I think sometimes we don't want to get down to like what we really need to work on. And but also it's, I guess the thing I think about is that if you do your work, it gives your kids permission to do their work. Like, again, like I think if we think about, parents don't come with a manual to how to raise kids. We don't have that. Like, we make our mistakes. We bring our wounded childhood into our parenting. We bring our wounded childhood into our marriage until we start doing the work. And when we start doing the work, we have this awareness. And it's not about, I think there are some psychopathic parents. I've met some clients whose parents are just horrible people who have set out to harm them. But the majority, 99.9% of the people that I meet, their parents just made mistakes. And right. if I can see a parent as a precious child who's made a mistake, who came from another mistake-filled childhood, like it's just progressively passed down, then we can see that we're just human. We're perfectly imperfect.
Yes, and we overvalue our survival skills. So I really tried to teach my sons to be people pleasers, because I thought, they need to know this. This is essential information. And they were very resistant to it. I worried so much for them because they were not interested in pleasing their teachers. And as I got in recovery, I say this to them all the time, thank God you didn't pick up what I was trying to force on you. Anyway, I want to talk a little bit about the program that you work in, because a
sure.
lot of our listeners are listening because they are at the information gathering stage of change.
Sure.
They're trying to decide what to do with this problem they've identified. So first of all, a shout out to any listeners who are in that stage of change where you haven't made a change yet. And a lot of times people that are still active in their addiction and listening to a program like this or anything else, they feel guilty. They feel like they're being hypocritical by being in addiction and listening to recovery resources. It's really that they're in a stage of change that's leading
Absolutely.
Up to change. So for
yes.
all of those people, and for those of us that are in change but don't know all of the differences between treatment, can you just speak a little bit about the difference between inpatient treatment and outpatient treatment, and then how those differ from detox, because most of us only know what we see on TV or have heard in the Amy Winehouse song. Like, we just know rehab is something in air quotes that we don't want to deal with. Right. What do those things mean, and who are the best candidates for each of those, or what? Talk about those things in general.
Sure, absolutely. Well, in Minnesota, we have kind of a funny tagline. Our license plates say "Land of 10,000 Lakes," and those of us in the recovery community call us "Land of 10,000 Treatment Centers." Minnesota is kind of a hotbed of recovery. We've got Hazel and Betty Ford, which is kind of a industry leader. They've been around for a very long time. You'll hear in recovery circles the Minnesota model, and they're really the ones that kind of started back in the 40s and 50s with starting to understand the brain science. And they worked really hand in hand with AA early. But they started to talk I think it's interesting, because I think if you read the doctor's opinion in AA, they actually talked about like the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. Like, they actually understood that we have a different body and a different mind. And so before all the brain science, they actually were having this language. But so really, like, on a road to recovery, I'm fortunate. I've never been a patient in detox. I was, not that I didn't need to probably, but I avoided that in my story. As a volunteer, I've gone to tell my story in detox. And detox sometimes is a place where you go to get medically stabilized, whether your drug of choice is alcohol or heroin. Cocaine is not really a physical withdrawal. It's more mental. So, but you could have some heart problems or something like that. So there's a medical detox, usually where they monitor your vitals. For some cases, they might give you things like Valium or things, Librium, to kind of keep your heart rate down and your blood pressure down. It's really about being safe. But a lot of times people will go to detox, they get to bed feeling better, they put them out on the street, and they go home and they start using again. And for those listeners that are in active addiction, it's okay. Like, it's okay that I'm glad that you're even listening and you're having this thought and you're having and entertaining a thought that maybe I want to change my life, but I'm not sure what to do next. And so if you feel like you need to medically detox, you can speak to your doctor. You can, in the state of Minnesota, we have a thing called Rule 25. And so you go in to get assessed. There's professional chemical dependency assessors. And they ask you these questions. There's six dimensions of life. So how are you feeling right now? Like, are you in acute intoxication or withdrawal? Are you medically stable? Do you have any biomedical diseases or things that you need to take care of immediately? Like, I'm diabetic and not taking care of my insulin. Maybe that would be one. Or I have a chemical disease that I haven't managed. Then emotional. So what are my emotional state? Do I have a diagnosis that I'm not treating? Am I supposed to be on medications for mental stability and I'm not taking them? Do I need to see a therapist or a psychiatrist? What's my need? The fourth is, what's the, kind of talk about that, the stage of change. Like, what are you ready for this? Or are you a little bit hesitant? And it's okay. And that stage of change is not linear. I like to think of it as a spiral. So we'll spiral up, and then we might spiral back down. Like, we might be, yes, gung-ho, ready to go. And then next week we're like, not so much. And so it's okay. And sometimes we relapse in that spiral. And it's not until we get to the very top of the spiral where we're maintaining sobriety. And I think about Gorski's model of recovery, where he says that long-term sobriety is not until like 3 years, so 3+ years. And so for those of us that are first struggling, the first few months of recovery are really difficult. It's hard. You have cravings. You have physical addiction, and it's difficult to stay in that place. And then the last one is, the last two are recovery environment and understanding about relapse. So do you understand like what triggers you to use? Do you understand the internal and external factors that make you want to use? And then the last one is recovery environment. Are you engaged in any kind of community support services? Do you have friends that are sober? What's your home life like? Are you safe at home? Do you even have a home? Some people are homeless or home insecure. And so they address those six dimensions, and they look at how you're showing up in those six dimensions, and they make a recommendation. Sometimes recommendation is to go to inpatient. So inpatient could be 30, 60, 90 days. It's usually some medical assisted treatment in the beginning. So if you they might have a detox there. So you could detox at that location. Some places require you to be 72 hours sober, which is kind of impossible for people who are using. Thank God mine didn't require that. But So then you have an inpatient facility, and they each have different tracks. So some people, so like for example, the retreat is not a clinical place, but they do a 30 or 90 day stay, and it's all 12-step immersion. Other places like Hazelden will be clinical, and they will talk about the brain science. They will suggest that you read the 12 steps, but they don't really enforce the 12 steps. And they talk more about things like shame or control or anger, and they talk about the underlying emotions that might be driving your addiction. You have process groups usually three or four times a week. You have education groups about alcoholism and addiction, and they have meetings. They have support meetings of different types. And then most places will, after your stay at a residential program, will probably suggest that you go to an outpatient program. And you have either intensive outpatient or just regular outpatient. And intensive outpatient is 3 to 5 days a week. Each insurance company has a different way of defining it. Where I work, we have 9 hours of programming a week. Some places have 12. But like in less intensive outpatient would be once a week or twice a week for 3 or 4 hours. And the good thing about outpatient is that you can make it work with your life. So if you're a mom, you got kids, you can come to day patient during the day while your kid's at school. Don't even have to disrupt your life. If you've got a job, you can go to work. You can come at night and go to the night programming. So it's very malleable and fits in well to people's lives. And there's different treatment centers have different specialties. So where I work at River Ridge in Eagan, Minnesota, and we use a Stephanie Covington curriculum where we are helping people with trauma and addiction at the same time. And we work very closely with a mental health team. So I can recommend my client to go see a mental health therapist. They literally can walk to another hallway and make that appointment and see a person in the same building. And the therapists have everything from EMDR to CBT to all different kinds of modalities of treatment. They also do the childhood wounding that I've talked about. And then we, on the chemical dependency side, we work on the Stephanie Covington module, talks about self and relationships and sexuality and spirituality. There's a little bit of 12 steps thrown into it, and we work with them one-on-one as well as a group. And that's kind of, in a nutshell, what happens. And every treatment center is a little bit different. Really finding what fits with you. I think early recovery, I think gendered recovery is very important. I think as you get more stable and more sober, I think you can mix the genders, but I think early recovery, it's really important that we specifically treat men and specifically treat women in separate groups. Women act differently around men. Men act differently around women. We also process differently. We talk about, in my group, we talk about man rules, right? Men are taught very early, don't cry, don't be vulnerable. Your one go-to emotion is anger, and stick with that one, right? And so we try to really focus on, with men, breaking down that anger part. And with women, we tend to be the victims of sexual violence, of trauma. And so we talk about that self-value and worth that I was speaking about earlier, that it's not tied to any kind of trauma that we've experienced, that it's not our fault. And so trying to build a self-esteem back up.
You know, it's so interesting that you talk about gendered recovery, how important that is, because I've always sort of felt a little bit funny about the fact that I don't go to meetings where men are. In my community, there's only one women's meeting a week, and that's the only one I go to. And I have always just thought it's because I have dad issues. Don't like being told what to do. And I assume that I'll become quieter and feel very, I'll have like a child response to men in the room. Or I might also have like a charm response to men in the room.
So
my instinct has been to stick to women's only meetings. But you're saying that that's kind of, there's some inherent value in that, that that's not necessarily a deficiency I need to work on.
I think it's great. Yeah. And I think sometimes in recovery, I don't think we sometimes don't trust other women. Like we don't know how to have a relationship with other women. We have relationships with men because it's easy, right? Like it's easier to, like you said, the charm response, or I can have a dad response, like where I feel like I'm a child. But more often than not, it's the charm response. So, I like the gendered. I mean, again, it doesn't mean that we don't need to learn how to be a part of each other's lives in recovery. And it's important that we teach men how to respect women and how to respect boundaries. I've had sponsees come to me and say, I'm at a meeting and a guy wants to hug me at the end of the night and I'm so uncomfortable, but I don't want to make him uncomfortable. And I'm like, really? Make him uncomfortable? Like, come on, seriously? Like, you have a body boundary and you get to say, no, I'd rather prefer to shake your hand. And this idea that we're set on this earth to make other people happy has got to stop, because it puts us in danger. Like, we ignore that kind of intuition that we have and we sometimes get harmed. So, but anyway, we went off on a tangent, but I think I like both. I like particularly an early recovery for women to go to women's meetings to kind of make a connection, to find friends, and to find community. That's why I like AA, is because it's free and it's accessible. And but there's also Women for Sobriety, there's Smart Recovery, there's all different kinds of recovery paths. And as long as you find something that is a recovering community, that if you walk in there and say, man, today was really crappy and I feel like drinking, that somebody else in that room understands what you're talking about.
Right. Yes. And just as a sidebar, I was doing like internal, like standing ovation, slow clap. You were saying, set your boundaries. Quit hugging people you don't want to hug. That's an issue for me.
relatives too. If you don't feel like hugging creepy Uncle Al, don't hug creepy Uncle Al. Like, love you, Al, but not hugging you.
Here's a handshake.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Now, we tend to think about treatment as something people do to get sober. But last year, I had a guest who talked about, I think she was 18 months sober, and she felt like she was sober and she felt solid in it, and yet she felt like she didn't like the way that she had set up her sobriety, if that makes sense. Mm. You know, she had sort of like self-directed her recovery and she was doing things she felt she was supposed to do, but something didn't feel right. And so she went to inpatient treatment for, I think, 30 days to get a fresh perspective and to restart. So should we be changing our thinking about that? Can people that do you see treatment as really only for people that are new in recovery to get sober? Or is it a tool that we should be thinking of more and more as something we can engage with at any stage of recovery to help us grow or get over a hump or feel more solid?
Yeah, I think that's the big rub, at least in the States anyway, is paying for it. Because if you can't pay out of pocket, if you don't show need, like if I'm not intoxicated or in a withdrawal state or in a greater sense of need, insurance won't pay for inpatient. And I think we're going to see with the healthcare system in America especially going more towards the outpatient module because it's cheaper. Like they don't have to pay for room and lodging, right?
Right.
Room and board. And so I think that reset button your guest was talking about, I think is really important, is seeing that maybe I have a need for something, and whether that need is fit I'm glad she was able to go to an inpatient and kind of do a reset. So I think it's important that we do that before we start using, right? Because that's a very good sign, like saying, yeah, I'm having struggles, and so I want to make sure that I'm going to stay sober. That's why there's different places. I would be more geared to maybe finding something like a spiritual retreat. I know you go to Kripalu quite a bit, so I'm looking forward to doing something like that. But maybe some people can't afford that. In my state, we have a thing called – we have different places that are called hermitages, and you can go for like a weekend, and it's literally a silent retreat. It's cheap. You can – it's sliding scale, and it's just a time to kind of reset. And it's a silent retreat, so you walk around and you study and you just pray and you meditate and you're quiet, and then at the end of the Sunday you process with people. So finding things in your community where you can find support, I think, would be important. But yeah, I think as our recovery services evolve, I think being able to find more services for people who need that exact thing, the reset would be important. I just don't know of anything funding-wise, like how you can go into inpatient. The retreat, like I've said before, is not insurance. It is the self-pay, but they also have scholarships available. And they are amazing, amazing group. I went there actually 6 months sober, and it's very spiritual. So finding a place that's not clinical, but the problem usually is going to be funding. So.
Okay, that's fantastic. That's a great tip. The other thing you talked about that I would like more information on, you talked about identifying your core issues. Where can we learn more about this, and how does it help us to learn what our own core issues are, and how do we do that? Where can we learn more about that?
Absolutely. Well, I think we both had mentioned Pia Melody earlier. She has some great books, Facing Codependence, Facing Love Addiction. And the Facing Codependence book actually has a compendium workbook. I don't know if you've used the workbook, but this, I think it's called Breaking Free, and it's quite extensive. So you can do some self-work that way. The looking online for post-induction therapy, I think, is really important. Finding a therapist that is trained in childhood wounding and core issues, that's what really took off for me. I think I was 7 years sober, and I walked into my therapist's office, and I'm like, I'm miserable. I have a great job. I'm in school. My life is good. And I feel this sense of loneliness that I can't seem to put my finger on. And she's like, are you ready? Are you, do you trust me? And I was like, yeah. And I did a 3-day intensive with her, which was me and three other women went through these core issues that we talked about. And it's an intensive work, but it was very cathartic. And I came out the other side feeling like, oh my God, I understand now. And then I wanted to be trained in it. So I started doing the training so I could become a PIT therapist at some point. But so yeah, I would look for therapists in your area that are Pia Melody trained. I think also somatic healing that Peter Levine does is also important, because that can go hand in hand with the trauma work. And just knowing that we all have issues, and they're in different varying degrees of importance. Like, so mine was the validation and control were the two important ones, but the sensation and crisis were just as important for me. And I think Pia Melody uses different language, and off the top of my head, I can't remember, but it's like self-esteem and stuff like that. So yeah, so looking for, I think, Pia Melody trained people. There's also, now there's a place you could go, Wickenburg, Arizona, where Pia Melody used to work, the Meadows. They are great with codependence and family settings and also family treatment. And I don't know what their pay schedule is. I have no idea how to pay for it. But you can go there to learn. I know that the retreats are a week long to 30 days long, and they do the intensives there as well.
Fantastic. Boy, you know a lot of stuff. Man, I need three more hours with you at least. I got to know this. You said you didn't graduate college, but you pretended to. Did your family think you graduated college, or were you just in denial that you didn't finish?
Yeah, they thought I did. They actually threw me a graduation party, and I walked. So it was bad. That's what I told you. I felt like a fraud. At the University of Kansas, there's this huge tradition where you walk down the hill. You walk through this big bell campanile, and people are walking down the hill into the stadium. And my thought that day was, how drunk can I get and how much pot can I smoke? That's where my focus was. And I had absolutely no reverence for the fact that there were thousands of other people in the stadium that were graduating, but I didn't really. But yeah, they threw me a graduation party, and I hid that secret from them for a very long time. Like, I finally came through to them and said, and just for the listeners, so you know, I completed my BA last summer, actually, 2019. So I am a graduate of the University of Kansas, I got dogs. And the good thing about my schooling now is, like, I have a 4.0, not only in addiction studies, but in all of my last 12 hours of bachelor's. And the lie I told myself was, I can't go back because they won't want me back. I'm too old. And for those women out there that think they're too old to go back to school, I would use a profane word, but bull crap. You can go back anytime. If you have a dream and a hope, and maybe what you've learned already is not what you want to do anymore, go back to school. We need women, and we need helpers, and we need people in the addiction field, particularly people in recovery. I think we have a special knack for it. So if there's a dream that you dream it and go for it.
Well, you are amazing. What a great place for us to wind up our conversation today. And I just want to thank you so much for shining your light, for telling your truth, and for telling us how it's done. I mean, not just showing us how you did it, but that everyone can do it. And that if you're not happy with where you're at, let's get you moved somewhere better. And knowing what the options are, I mean, I'm so grateful for you sharing your story and your knowledge with us today.
Thank you, Jean, and thank you for providing a platform for covering women. And a shout out to all those women out there. Find your community, whether it's online or in your hometown. Reach out to other women. Ask for help. It's not the end of the world. I really hope that we can fight the stigma of addiction and mental health disorders, because we all have them. We all know someone, and it's time that we stop hiding it. So, again, thank you for the platform, and I hope to see you in Miami.
I'm so great. And that would be the Miami She Recovers conference or retreat or convention.
Conference.
And that's in May of this year, May 2020. So if listeners want to learn more about that, is it sold out? There's probably a waiting list, but.
It might be. Yeah. Well, then
She Recovers.
The next one, right?
Yes. Well, SheRecovers.co is the website where you can learn more about that. And I actually think they were talking about some scholarships. So there's probably some information on applying for scholarships at that. They have a songwriting competition that's going on in conjunction with that, and the speaker lineup is fantastic. So
it's gonna be amazing.
A little plug for She Recovers there. You all know how much I love them and how I have made so many amazing connections through their events, including you, Kendra. So
absolutely, thank you.
Hooray.
Well, and
hooray for us.
Hooray for us, yeah. And you are you've got my information. If anyone happens to be in the Minneapolis area and ever needs support or help, you can get my information from Jean and reach out to me. I'm always available to talk on the phone or email or whatever, or meet for coffee. So
okay. So anyone message me, which is thebubblehour@gmail.com, and I'll get you in touch with Kendra.
Perfect. Thank you so
Excellent.
Much, Jean.
Thank you, Kendra. Stay on the line while the music plays and we'll chat off air. For everyone else, thank you so much for being here. And until next time, please do take good care.
I own it. I did that. Not proud, but that was me. And when I face a little dignity, not looking for excuses. I just want to be free from power, weakness head on me. In a dark corner is where shame lies behind. Oh, you think you're strong just 'cause you keep it on the side. It just rob you of your pride. Turn the light on, turn the light on. You can shine when you see. Oh, I did that. Not proud that was me. And when I face it, I take that. A little dignity. I'm not looking for excuses. I just want to be free from power. Happy.